Good afternoon, and welcome. Welcome to the Fulbright Commission here at Yenisur. This is the Fulbright Commission, also known as USEF Nepal. And we're very, very, very happy today to be co-hosting this event with the Social Science Baja. For those of you who I haven't had the opportunity to meet, my name is Laurie Vasily. I'm the Executive Director here at the Fulbright Commission, USEF Nepal. So I'll speak half in English and half in Nepali. Social science baha le pani chai co-host gari rakhe chha ani ma bitin shabda chai bolera aru haru lai chai yo mic dichu tara maile chai yo awasta ma chai ekdam bolne man pani thiyo ani khushi bhayera kiniki ta maile chai dherai rani dekhi pani chai Sarah Schneiderman lai chai chineke nai chai ho ani chai wa yaha Nepal ma aunu bhayeko pahilo chuti aunu bhayeko chai ta ए पहिलोचोटि आउनु भएको त होइन तर आउनु भएको सुरुमा चाहिँ त आउनु भएकोमा चाहिँ त फुल ब्राइट भन्ने चाहिँ अवार्ड ग्रान्ड स्कलरसिप पाएर पनि आउनु भएको थियो त्यो चाहिँ 1999 म थियो अनि त्यस पछि आएर पनि चाहिँ उहाँ फुल ब्राइट स्पेसलिस्ट पाएर पनि आउनु भएको थियो त्यो उहाँ चाहिँ पिरियोटी बेलामा पनि चाहिँ फुल ब्राइट स्टुडेन्ट रिसर्चर भएर चाहिँ आउनु भएको थियो अनि चाहिँ त भर्खर चाहिँ पढ्दा यो साल फुल ब्राइट स्पेसलिस्ट पाएर पनि चाहिँ आउनु भएको थियो खास यो फुल ब्राइट भन्ने तपाईँहरूले चाहिँ त पहिले थाहा नभएको चाहिँ फुल ब्राइट भन्ने के हो भन्ने कुराहरू चाहिँ कस्तो छ भने चाहिँ यो एउटा मान्छेको नाम हो फुल ब्राइट भनेको चाहिँ जे विलियम फुल ब्राइट भन्ने मान्छेको नाम हो अनि यो मान्छेले चाहिँ अमेरिकन चाहिँ सेनेटमा बस्नु भएको उहाँले चाहिँ त म्युचुअल अन्डरस्ट्यान्डिङको लागि चाहिँ हामी एक अर्कालाई अझै राम्रो बुझ्यो हामीले चाहिँ एक अर्कालाई राम्रोसँग बुझ्यो भने चिनियो भने चाहिँ त हामी एक अर्कालाई मर्दैनौँ भन्ने सवालमा चाहिँ यो स्थापित गर्नुभएको थियो खास चाहिँ त इट्स बेसिकली अबाउट पिस प्रमोटिङ पिस एन्ड म्युचुअल अन्डरस्ट्यान्डिङ अनि मैले चाहिँ यो इभेन्ट हुँदैछ भन्ने कुराहरू थाहा पाएर मैले त्यतिखेर 1999 चाहिँ पायो जिगेर चाहिँ सेरा स्नाइडरम्यानलाई चाहिँ त लेख्नु भएको चाहिँ त्यतिखेर के लेख्नु भएको थियो भन्ने चाहिँ कुराहरू हेरेँ अनि अरू त्यसमा ठुलो एम्बेरेसिङ थियो मैले त्यतिमा के बताएँ भने चाहिँ एकदम यो इभेन्टको लागि एकदमै मिठो चढ्ने खालको शब्दहरू पनि देखाएँ उहाँले लेख्नु भएको त्यतिखेर पनि एकदम मिठो एकदम चाहिँ राम्रो लेख्ने मान्छे थियो अहिले पनि चाहिँ अब यो किताब पनि चाहिँ हामीले पढेर चाहिँ त्यो पनि देखाउँछौँ भन्ने चाहिँ मलाई थाहा छ तर त्यतिखेर उहाँले चाहिँ त उहाँको आफ्नै ग्रान्ड मदर अनि ग्रान्ड मदरको ब्रदरको बारे लेख्नु भएको थियो अनि म अलिक पढ्छु है उहाँ त्यतिखेर चाहिँ फेरि नेपालमा पर्खिनु भएको थियो अनि सी वाज राइटिङ अबाउट हर ग्रान्ड मदर एन्ड हर ग्रान्ड मदर्स ब्रदर विथ नेम इज छिम एन्ड छिम वाज अ प्रमिनेन्ट फोटो जर्नलिस्ट एट दिस टाइम हि टुक फोटोग्राफ्स इन पोस्ट वार युरोप एन्ड प्री नेसन इजरायल So at the end of her application essay, she wrote, With my grandmother's pen in my pocket and Chin's camera in my hand, my work in this land, so different from the places they knew, can be carefully crafted. As I continue to write, photograph, and above all observe, personal and cultural histories will weave themselves through my work, integrating my own particular experience with the larger currents that course beneath it. अनि मैले चाहिँ त्यो पढेर एकदम खुसी भएको थिएँ किनकि चाहिँ त यही किताब नै चाहिँ त यसको उदाहरण जस्तै चाहिँ हो खास चाहिँ दिस बुक इज अ रिजल्ट अफ अ प्रोसेस द्याट बिगेन विथ इज भेरी वर्ड एन्ड आई थॉट द्याट वाज रियली क्वाइट प्रेसियस एन्ड ब्युटिफुल बट इन ह्याभिङ सेड मच माइसेल्फ नाउ आई विल हैंड ओवर द माइक टु दीपक थापा द सोशल साइंस बाहा who is the co-host of this event today. So thank you for coming on a day that is very difficult to come out and get here. We're very happy that you're here, and I'm sure that this will be just a wonderful discussion. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Laurie. Can I request the panelists to please come to the front? Sangeet Sarah, Janaji, Sangeet Ji, Sven, Sugit. On behalf of the organization, I'd like to invite you here this afternoon, this evening, to an event that is that gives me immense pleasure, mainly because Sarah has been a friend for almost 20 years. I've known her since the time she came out to Nepal as a fresh out of college. And it gives me great pleasure and an honor to invite her here again as a scholar and published author. And this is something that I really cherish. I wouldn't like to say anything more except that, you know, the speakers are here. Except that in Nepali, I'd just like to say that कार्यक्रम धेरै जसो इङ्ग्लिसमा हुँदैछ तर नेपालीमा पनि कसैले केही कुराहरू सोध्न मन लाग्छ भने सबैजना नेपाली बुझ्ने नै हुनुहुन्छ माथि किताब इङ्ग्लिसमा छ त्यसले गर्दाखेरि त्यसको बारेमा पनि व्याख्या गर्दाखेरि अब इङ्ग्लिसमै गर्नुपर्ने हुन्छ तर त्योमा नबुझेका चिजहरू केही छ भने नेपालीमा गर्नुभए पनि हुन्छ
Sorry, I need to speak from here. Can everybody hear me if I speak from here?
Yes?
Okay.
What's up?
Ah, okay. Well, the problem is the remote here doesn't seem to work, so I'm going to need to...
I got it today.
Okay.
Mother and father, older brother and sister-in-law, older sister and brother-in-law, younger brother and sister-in-law, younger sister and brother-in-law, son and daughter, I offer service and greetings to you all. This is a Tangmi greeting in the Tangmi language with which rituals of ethnicity begin. And it recognizes all of those present at an event with invocations of kinship. So I'd like to begin my brief comments here today in the same way, and also with the dedication, as at the beginning of the book, to all of the members of the Tangmi community who contributed to this project, but didn't live to see its end in the form of the book. This book has been 15 years in the making, and as Laurie said, it feels very fitting to hold this initial discussion of it here with all of you, as it was with a Fulbright grant in 1999 and 2000 that the project that became this book began. So I was just thinking as I walked in, I have not been in this auditorium for many, many years, but still, it feels like a kind of home to me, one of the many homes I have in Nepal. And thank you very much to Laurie Vassily and the Fulbright Commission for hosting us here today. I'm grateful for their ongoing support over time. And I'd also like to thank Social Science Baha for organizing the academic program, especially Deepak Kappa, with whom it's always a great pleasure to work. I would also like to thank especially the Nepal Tangmi Samaj, the representative organization of the Tangmi community here in Nepal. I should just say briefly, for those who might be wondering, why Tangmi and Tangmi? I don't have time to go into all the details, but that's in the book. But basically, Tangmi is the ethnonym by which members of the group call themselves in their own language. Tangmi is the name that's been used for them by the state in both Nepal and India. So it's the term that's usually used in official discussions on documents and so forth. But I've chosen to use Tangmi in the book out of respect for the way people choose to refer to themselves in internal context. So I'm very grateful to the Nepal Tangmi Samaj, whose many members are here today, for their ongoing support, especially the current chairman, Bin Kumar Tangmi, and the secretary, Sukhbir, who's here with us. I also want to especially welcome members of the Tangmi community from outside of Kathmandu who have been collaborators in this research, and whom I feel very honored to have here today, Man Bahadur Thami and Ram Kumari Thami from Tropati Sindhu Palchuk, and Veer Bahadur Sundar and Kedar Thami, who come from Susko Chimawati in Doloka. And there are many others here today. I hope you'll forgive me for not listing every name, but all of you have been very important to the making of this book. Also, I'd like to thank the many friends from outside the Thami community here in Nepal who have been a great support over time. And if I can have the next slide, Deepak, just as a mode of recognition, I've listed the major supporters of this research over time here. I first visited the Thami areas of Doloka and Sindhu Palchuk district in 1998 with Mark Turin, who unfortunately is not here today. As many of you know, he later became my husband, and we've shared much of the life and work that has gone into the book here. Mark had at that time in 1998 just begun his own PhD research, which was then in the linguistics program, and he had set out to document the Thami language, about which very little was known, at least in scholarly context at that time. So I traveled with him, and on that first trip we spent several weeks, and we crisscrossed both Doloka and Sindhu Palchuk, visiting many of the major Thami settlements, Chokati, Piska, Druskun in Sindhu Palchuk, Suspa Chemawati, Lapilang, Alampu, Popatagu, Tanitagu, many others with whom people may be familiar in Doloka. When I returned to Kathmandu from that trip, I scoured bookstores and libraries for information about the Thami with whom I had just spent such a very fascinating and really enlightening time. And I couldn't find anything. And I found this really puzzling because clearly there was this vibrant world out there with a language which was very much in use, probably more so at that time even than it is now, and also a whole cultural world which I had just begun to see. And yet there was almost nothing written about it. It's kind of puzzling that this relatively sizable group, the population officially is approximately 30,000 in Nepal. Of course, there are many debates about where those numbers come from, with then another 8,000 or so in India. And so, you know, it's not huge, but it's also not a tiny population. There are many groups with smaller populations who have been the subject of much greater ethnographic inquiry here. And so that really set up the puzzle for me about why this was and also what the Thami actually were all about. And I set out then to understand that in part through that Fulbright grant that Lori read some of the materials from. So this question, Thami kehu, right? What is a Thami or what is Thami? It's not my question. It's a question that members of the Thami community face very frequently, every day probably, or very often at least in their daily lives, where they are in encounters with members of other communities in Nepal, other kinds of institutional agents and so forth, in which they are pressed to explain themselves. And without being instantly recognizable as one of the sort of major ethnic groups about whom we have a lot of information, it's actually very difficult for them to situate themselves in those kinds of responses, or at least it was at that time. And one thing I'd like to say is that this situation has really changed significantly, I would say, in this last 15 years. So the book really is my humble attempt to provide some very initial beginning answers to that question. And let me say here that I see it really as a beginning, as a foundation for what I hope will be much future research. As far as I'm aware, and I think I've pretty much read what there is out there, it's the first comprehensive ethnography of the group in English. There are many other materials in Nepali. Many of them are materials produced by Thami community members over time. Some of those materials date back to the earliest that I have found in Nepal that's actually published and still accessible is from the early 1980s. In India, there is material that goes back to the 1930s. So that archive is there and is actually a kind of base for, I think, a great deal of additional research, as well as, of course, the research into ongoing contemporary dynamics. I'm also really excited about all of the new work that's emerging, especially in film and other media, as well as in digital forms. And many members of the Taimi community have been involved with making a series of different kinds of films, both documentaries and other kinds of genres, which I think will be really interesting to watch. After that initial trip, as I began to spend more time in Nepal's Taimi villages, I began to realize that the people I was meeting were anything but sedentary inhabitants of bounded village environments. Instead, their livelihoods relied on regular cross-border mobility between Nepal, India, and historical Tibet, or what is now China's Tibetan Autonomous Region, which, for those of you familiar with the area, and now I can have the next slide, which is a map, is very close to the Taimi areas of residence in the heartland of Dolakhand and Dukhalchuk. They're only a few kilometers as the crow flies from the border towns of Khasa and Nyalam on the Tibetan side of the border. So I found that people were regularly crossing that border, as well as spending up to half of their year in India, especially in Darjeeling and Sikkim. And that fact became the impetus for my actual dissertation research, which happened later between 2004 and 2006. And I set out to understand how such cross-border mobility was shaping ethnic identity for Taimi community members in all of these contexts, and spent much of that time period moving back and forth between all of these locations as a doctoral student. And sorry, the map's a little hard to see from here. I'm filling with this.
People are probably familiar enough, but this is the main Taimi area of residence in Nepal, although I should say that there are Taimi settlements in many other communities. There are 15 districts with branches and stretch offices of the Nepal Taimi Kanj, for instance, especially in Surai, and Japa is also an important location. And then Darjeeling and Sikkim have the souls of the Indian community.
So, this brings me then to the central agendas of, or arguments of the book, which I just want to outline in brief here. And I don't want to take too much more time, so obviously I'm not going to go through the book or chapters in great detail, and I invite you to look at it all outside afterwards. But just a brief overview here in the next slide.
Oh, it's too small to see, I'm sorry. You should have put it on a couple of different slides.
Okay, so the first objective really of the book, and this evolved over time, was to provide a comprehensive ethnography of the Taimi, in a sense written as a classical ethnography, because that didn't exist, with chapters on origin myths, economics, political and associational life, rituals and deities, territorial belonging, life cycle rituals, and kinship and descent. And the idea was to structure all of these chapters in a cross-border fashion. So in each of these thematic chapters, I'm actually talking about what happens in both Nepal and India and how it's mediated across the border. So in doing that, this is the second objective, to reflect critically on the ongoing value of ethnography to political projects of recognition and consider the anthropologist's role in such projects. Third, then, to take seriously both cited village-level experiences in particular places and the broader dynamics of cross-border mobility in which those experiences are embedded. Fourth, in so doing, to argue for the importance of trans-regional analytical frameworks that allow us to understand processes within Nepal in relation to dynamics in India, China, and possibly other sites further afield. And then fifth and finally, and this is more on the theoretical contributions of the work, building upon all of these insights to make an argument about ethnicity with two key points. First of all, that ethnicity in action can be understood as a collective project with contributions by diverse actors across the community, as well as a productive ritual project that is subjectively real for those who participate in it, and not just a strategic or instrumental manipulation that results from state control or market forces. And then the second point of the arguments about ethnicity, that it's at once shaped by country-specific discourse and policy, yet is also dependent on a feedback loop or dialogues between members of communities across state borders. In other words, nation-states remain a key frame for the production of ethnicity, even and perhaps especially in context of high cross-border mobility. So that's really a 300-plus page book in a nutshell. I just want to say a few more things before passing it on to the other speakers who have joined us. The formal research for the book ended in 2008, and I think this is always an issue in writing academic books, but the time, it's such a slow process that you always feel like, oh, there's one more thing I want to put in there, or this is no longer relevant somehow. So the introduction of the book does try to relate the arguments to what are still very much ongoing political issues regarding the constitutional process, especially in relation to ethnicity, identity, and territory here in Nepal, and also the Gorkhaland movement in India. I'd be very interested in talking further in question and answer as well about, you know, what this all means, what having published a book like this at this particular moment actually means, and what its sort of future trajectory might be as well. And in conclusion, I just want to spend a minute talking about what the earthquake has meant for Tengni communities. The Tengni heartland, as I showed you, is in eastern Sindhu Palchuk and western Dolaka, some of the most affected areas. And I just returned from some days in Dolaka on Friday. Nearly every house, school, and community building no longer stands. And it was very difficult for me to understand this from afar, although in the wake of the disaster, I did my best to stay in contact and use whatever resources and networks I could to support our Tengni colleagues and the broader communities, as well as their neighbors. And during my visit last week, I was really heartened to find that people have been very ingenious in making do with what they have and are getting on with life as well as possible, given the immense challenges. I think the sense of what the future holds is still very much unknown. And again, that's very interesting to deal with as an author, having written something that in one way requires itself to be definitive as a book, but realizing that much of what I've written about in terms of both people's livelihoods and also the built environment is no longer as it was. So I initially felt really uncomfortable talking about the book in the wake of the earthquake, as nearly everyone who features in it, at least from the Nepal context, has suffered. So I decided to write a blog post on the University of Pennsylvania Press website to describe what had happened and also bring attention to the ongoing need for support in Nepal. And I think the next slide is that. So, these are a few shots. Those are a few images from Dolaka, of the temporary shelters and what the environment looks like as of 2 days ago. And then the next slide, please. Yeah, that's the blog, and it just, you know, gives some background to what's happened and has many links also to the work of many people who are here today as well, just trying to give people who might end up reading the book also a kind of update. So I invite you to look at that. I also sought funding to make a certain number of copies of the book available to sell to benefit earthquake victims within the Tengni community. So to that end, the books that are available for sale today are here at a special discounted rate of 2,000 rupees. And all of the proceeds from those sales today will go to the recently established Nepal Tengni Samaj Fund to support the approximately 50 Tengni families who lost members in the earthquake. So please do know if you buy the book, all of the everything will go towards that cause. For those who can do so, the book is also available to order online. There's a flyer with a discount code that's just outside, so if you are going back to the U.S. or somewhere else and are able to access a copy that way, I invite you to do so and use the discount code. Unfortunately, due to some issues with the publisher, a South Asian edition isn't available yet, but I hope this will be possible in the near future, and I didn't want to wait to introduce the book for that reason. But it should be available in the future. In the meantime, there will be an additional shipment of books for sale fairly soon at Mandala Book Point in the coming months, so please do let people know. I just wanted to say, too, that a significant portion of the book is available to view online for free through Amazon Look Inside and Google Books. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see that. And so it's not the whole book, but actually I was really impressed to see that nearly the whole introduction is available and excerpts from every chapter. So I think you can get quite a good idea of it there. Okay, so that's really it with one brief further thing to say. I just wanted to read one paragraph from the very end of the book, which seems particularly poignant to me now in the wake of the earthquake as well, and then I will turn it over to everybody else. So in trying to conclude the book, I sort of imagine what the future might bring to the area in Nepal, and this was written probably now for the last time, for the first time in about 2009 and finally revised in 2012. For the vast majority of Thangni, life will go on in the action of the everyday, hand mills perhaps giving way to electric mills, thatched roofs to aluminum, rickety jeeps to air-conditioned buses. If the last 10 years are any indication of what's to come, new roads will be carved out of hillsides, schools built alongside them, and loans taken to buy land elsewhere. Territorial deities will continue to gather in response to the palaki of young gurus, and new temples will be built in their honor, where Thangni may come on pilgrimages of self-recognition. Thangni will be born, marry, and die, affirming their individual and communal Thangniness in the process. Houses will remain starting points for journeys across borders, as well as anchors to territory, cultural heritage sites, and a symbol of all of these things. In the future, I hope that when some Thangni hear the question, Thangni ke ho, some will point to this book, which is my modest contribution to their quest. And so I'll finish with that. The last line here, which I feel very strongly about, is continue to feel strongly about, is that although the contents of the book may not please everyone equally, I hope that its symbolic form will be of use to all. And so with that, I offer it to all of you.
We next have Dr. Jalakray, who teaches at the Trivandrum University with a special interest in issues related to ethnicities and identities. The most apt person to cover that book.
Namaste and Shivati, everyone. First, I would like to, Sunita, I would like to thank Sarah Schneider, my good friend for a long time, the author of the book, and the two organizers for inviting me to give my comments on the book. Just to relocate how I'm, just to locate myself, like how I'm reading the book, I do work on issues of indigeneity, territory. For my PhD research, I work with an indigenous group from the Eastern Tarai called Himal, where I also argue some of the major arguments that Sarah also has expressed in her book. But having said that, this is a very excellent book in many ways. It is a new book. It provides new perspective to study, particularly issues of ethnicity and the making of ethnic identity. Since this is a very dense book, I read it once and skim some of the chapters again, but still it's not possible for me to condense the book and say something about the book in 10 minutes, the given time. So what I would like to do today is highlight some of the major points which I think are very important in the book, and also raises some questions which might be helpful for us to, for the QA or discussion sessions later. Why ethnicity matters is one central question that this book engages with. And we all know now, since for the last two decades, ethnicity has been one of the most contested and politically charged topic in Nepal. particularly, you know, with the political changes, with the elections of the Kashmir Chishtian Bill the second, you know, the whole nation seems to be polarized. Scholars are polarized. You know, people, you know, there are people who are, you know, claiming for, you know, why ethnicity should be an issue, and some are just like saying, you know, oh, you know, ethnicity, ethnic identities are social construct and it's fluid. So, you know, so basically claiming rights based on ethnic identity is a nonsense issue. So, you know, in that, in this kind of polarized time, the publication of this book is, I think, a very much a welcome contribution to ongoing debates about ethnicity, particularly for scholars project. And I'm sure that the book also will be very important. It will contribute towards understanding the complexity, the challenges of ethnic activism in Nepal. One of the, you know, when I finished reading the book, one thing I was, you know, what it gave me strike is the argument of the book, the ethnographic data that supports the argument is ethnicity is a regional form of action through which people consciously produce and objectify identity as a sacred object. So when we take identity as a sacred object, I think it opens up new ways of thinking about ethnicity and the way people are engaged consciously in making their ethnic identity matter. So perhaps the question, you know, would be, what does it mean when you say that identity is a sacred object? For me, when I read the book, it directed me towards some important points. First, when we talk about ethnicity, it is not just, you know, there is an increasing emphasis, particularly in the media writings against ethnic federalism and claims of ethnic identity making. I can name, for example, my respected teachers. Chaitanya Mitra is one spokesperson of that school of thought, and Sarah also begins her book with one of some of the ideas of Professor Mitra. So the idea that ethnicity is a social construction has become a very, you know, an appealing concept for many, and particularly those who are writing against, you know, issues of ethnicity and rights based on ethnic claims. So I think in a way this book for me challenges that kind of approach and asks us to look at how people, not just activists, how people on the ground really produce ethnic identity through various contexts, through various means, engaging not only in their village status but also through transnational migration, mobility and activism. So having said that, Regional of Ethnicity, the book, to my knowledge, is a pioneering transnational ethnographic study of the mobility, ethnicity and ritual action of one community in three discrete nation states, Nepal, India, China, China's Tibetan Autonomous Regions, though the focus on TAR is peripheral in the book. The continuous circular migration of Sangi people in these three regions, particularly between Nepal and Darjeeling region of India, dates back to the mid-19th century, and this book shows how the practice of cross-border mobility and their experiences of living in the two nation-states under various regimes of state-led management of diversity has provided the Sangni people with both opportunities and challenges of asserting their identity for what the author calls existential recognition by various agents with power to recognize as well as to deny the recognition of Sangni identity. So, to me this book is an exemplary ethnography of connections which shows how Sangni living in India and Nepal, Nepal and India, read Darjeeling from different socio-economic backgrounds, not only the middle class or the rich educated elite, if you like, generation and political orientations with differential relationship with the nation states to which they belong as citizens contributes in producing and objectifying the collective Sangam identity. The author is very successful in showing how Sangam ethnicity is continuously in the process of making and remaking through the continual circular dialects, confrontations and mediations between various Sangmi from Nepal and India in their efforts of producing and objectifying a common and shared identity for various pragmatic and political effects. In particular, I find the discussion and analysis of how Sangmi in Darjeeling engaged with the Indian state in pursuit of their recognition as OBC group in the past and now as a scheduled tribe, tribal identity for connecting themselves with the Sangmi from Nepal, very insightful for my own work. Because I focus on the Indian side, because there have been many books in Nepal written on ethnic identity formations, which looks at particularly in Nepal, and also like focus on the rituals. But this book is unique in the sense, you know, it engages the practices and performance from both nation states, and it provides very important insights to understand the complex process of ethnic identity formation. The author's brilliant analysis of ethnicity as a form of ritual action, which he examines through two central analytical concepts of practice and performance, makes this book uniquely distinctive and original from other similar works on ethnicity, migration, and mobility. She writes, as the author argues, if I talk about practice and performance, it's going to take more than 10 minutes. But basically, what is the center between practice and performance, to me, is the need for recognition. The need for recognition of one's identity by other agents and other social actors, institutions. So recognition of one's identity by other recognizing agents becomes crucial for the Sangmi people. For them, such recognizing agents always include their deities when they worship and placate their deities. In other words, recognition by deities is fundamental to Sangmi's sense of who they are as a collective Sangmi people. And what Sangmi do to continue getting recognized from their deities constitute the domains of practice. Such practices of rituals are always mediated by the guru, the Sangmi ritual practitioner. It is my impression that the power relation and the ritual act of recognition between Sangmi and their deities are based on ethics reciprocity. Sangmi at least do not suffer from the misrecognition of their identity from their deities as long as they continue to practice the ritual offerings for the rituals. But recognition by the deities is not adequate to express Sangmi identity. Sangmi, as Sarah has already mentioned, Sangmi have long suffered marginalizing effects of misrecognition of their identity from the non-Sangmi, the state, and others. In this context, recognition is a politically contested act interfaced with unequal power relation between Sangmi, other recognizing agents such as the dominant non-Sangmi social groups, INGOs, the Nepali, and Indian states in particular. Hence, Sangmi are required to enact various performances which are ritualized actions carried out by Sangmi individuals for the consumption of outsiders, most notably the state officials in India and Nepal and NGOs in Nepal with specific political and economic goals. Here, I do have one question to raise to Sarah or perhaps we can discuss that in the Q&A session also. In the book, she discusses how Sangmi in India, living in India, are required, in a way compelled to perform in a certain way so as to get recognition as OBC or as a scheduled tribe. And so for that, they're also, in the Indian context, based on the books. The recognition of tribal identity also required that the family should prove that, at least so that they are quote-unquote primitive people. They live in geographical isolation. In a way, it's a very much a colonial categories of tribal identity to which family must perform if they are willing to get recognized by the Indian state. And that part, that kind of ethnographic examples makes sense, and it's wonderfully done. But however, in some way, Sarah also alludes to the fact that the family in Nepal are also, to some extent, required to perform that kind of identity in order to get recognized by the state and particularly by NGOs in Nepal. So the question that I have is, do family in Nepal really need to perform their ethnic identity as their contemporaries in India to get recognition from the state and INUs in Nepal? Of course, families are involved, families and all indigenous groups are involved in what, you know, we can call politics of culture revival, you know, claiming their, the original identity, you know, revival of their language, their marriage practice, so on. But when an NGO or a state wants to recognize Adivasi Janjati, do they really have to perform in a way to get the recognition? I think the book in some way gives that impression that Adivasi in Nepal are required to do so. And I don't have. So, in the second part of my presentation, one thing that I loved about the book that I want to share here, and which I think we all face, we all anthropologists working with the people writing about their, particularly those who work with the activism and activism, we always face that challenges. So the book for me is also an excellent book about ethnographer and Sarah and her friendship with the family people. We all know, you know, Sarah has been working for a long time. But the question also is, how do you write about the people that you work with when they particularly come up with, you know, demands like that we write ethnography in a certain way, perhaps in a way that, you know, your academic training, your theoretical standpoint, or what the academic circle say may not allow you to do so. Let me give some examples. Sarah is very careful in her analysis, in her book, about, you know, there is a conflict going on. In any group, in activism, you know, it's full of conflicts. For example, there is a conflict between gurus and activists regarding, you know, gurus emphasizes orality, whereas activists emphasizes the sexuality, written forms of representation. Or there are many, there are different ways in which activists want to represent the culture. And now, I think the book also shows how we can still maintain, how ethnographer can still maintain some sort of distancing, at the same time, you know, be very much attentive towards, you know, the kind of challenges these family activists are going through, why they are demanding, why they are trying to write in a certain way, why they are trying to represent their culture, their identity in a certain way. I think that kind of, like, you know, sensitivity is something that is very commendable. And I think coming back to her, you know, so what is ethnography? How can ethnographer be in a position, in a contested position, how, for example, you know, let me bring in one point here. For example, you know, in the last few years, there has been, for example, people like Uttama Sharma, for example, have openly criticized what he calls foreign anthropologists and anthropologists training West, people like me perhaps, for making the issues of ethnicity larger, bigger than what it is. So, in a way, so I think this book you know, it also challenges, also like gives us a new perspective of how we as an ethnographer, we as scholars, can be sympathetic towards the issue, but at the same time, write or even criticize what's going on there without without making the activists look like villains. I think to that, you know, to that extent, this book is really an exemplary piece of work. I think I should stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Janaki. Sarah, shall we have you respond to everything at the end?
Yes.
Yeah. Next we have Dr. Samriti Khadil, who is not an anthropologist, a sociologist. She is a research anthropologist at present.
Thank you. Okay, first I'd really like to congratulate and thank Sarah for an excellent piece of work. And a lot parts of what I wanted to say, Janakji has already covered, so I won't repeat that. But my perspective, I think, would be more sociological. Although I think there are lots of times when I find this distinction between anthropology and sociology almost artificial, because, you know, these domains or these disciplines really cross and talk to each other. The book, I mean, overall is very engaging, very informative. It has a very good combination of theory and empirical data. So it's very theoretically grounded and empirically rich. I think the book will be an important contribution to anthropology, sociology, South Asian studies, South Asian ethnographies, cultural political studies, migration studies, and of course it adds to the scholarship on the ethnographies of Nepal, that is the Thangmi communities in Nepal and in India. So I would think that this book can be called an example of, I think, what they call engaging anthropology, but the author is engaged very deeply, but at the same time, like as Janakji said, has really tried to maintain that distance and try to bring out, you know, whatever she's learned in the form of a book. So at that level, I think an academic scholar also needs that form of distance and objectivity, although I think objectivity would be kind of difficult. So I think there were times in the book where I felt that Sarah should have explained a little more about the processes of how did she maintain that distance. You know, in her writing, I do see that that dialectic, that dilemma she's facing. In many chapters, she says, you know, when she's asked by the gurus, by a lot of activists who are the performers who want to make a claim to the state, wanting her to record everything, you know, so that nothing is, let's say, corrupted or polluted, so that things come out as they are. And at the same time, she's the researcher, you know, so the tension is seen throughout the book, although she doesn't really explain in terms of, you know, the methods. I think as sociologists, I would say, okay, the methods section maybe should have been explained a little more, but it's working very beautifully. Sarah has been very... I think be very successful as an ethnographer. You know, when you go as an ethnographer, you observe so much. You observe the implicit, you observe the day-to-day, the taken-for-granted assumptions. And the duty, I think, or responsibility of an ethnographer is actually to bring it out, you know, as she has done in the book, and make these things very obvious. You know, and she's done this very well. So she's attempted to present a native view, I would say, although I think her position has been more of an outsider-insider, and maybe towards the end she'd be seen as an insider-outsider, I don't know, this is dichotomy. So at the end, and in the beginning, you know, she said that I hope my contribution will be in such a way that anyone who wants to know about the Thangmi in Nepal will actually pick up this book. And I think she has been successful. I think now if anybody wants to study about, let's say, Janjatis or overall when ethnographies are directed, this will be one book about the history, culture, and even economy of the Thangmi. The book, you know, provides very rich details of the Thangmi rituals, about the myths, the origins of myths, Thangmi organizational history, both in Nepal and Darjeeling. So what is very beautifully done, I felt, by Sarah, was this parallel. You know, she's maintained this this juxtapose in a way the developments in Darjeeling and in Nepal, and you know how they interconnect and intersect. And I think that's kind of difficult as a scholar to do, and she's brought this out very well. I found, as a sociologist, so you know, I found the chapters on circular migration, the struggle, circular migration, the sense of belongingness, the sense of citizenship, when the Thangnis of Nepal go to Darjeeling, when they migrate there, that chapter is very sociological in that sense. You know, a lot of the chapters talk about the origins, the myths, the rituals, which is also very important, informative. But from a sociological standpoint, that chapter really gives you an idea. You know, their struggle when the laborers, for example, when they go to Darjeeling, their identity as migrants. But at the same time, their very central role in almost being a transmitter of Thangni culture when they go to India, because the Thangnis of Nepal are considered to have, you know, like original culture, if you want to call that. So this is done very well. Although at times then, you know, as sociologists, I was thinking, okay, maybe a little more on the conditions of the workers, should have been there a little more this time. But I know at the end of it, it's very hard, you know, years in the making, the book, you have to condense it to like 300 pages, and it's not so simple, you can't really cover everything. The other chapter I found very sociologically interesting was also she shows how the history of organizations, you know, Thangni organization in Darjeeling as well as in Nepal, and she goes back to the 1950s and she traces and one thing done very beautifully in the book, which Janakji touched upon, is this whole she views this concept of practice and performance, and she's woven that those two concepts very well throughout. So you see this dialectic or even the tension as well as the convergence of practice and performance at every level, whether it's about myths, the origin of myths, whether it's that tension between the sacred through the oral power the guru has, or the textual, you know, which may not be considered that sacred, and then the tension between the younger generation of activists who actually want everything to be documented, to be written, whereas the gurus feel that, you know, that's sacrilegious, that they don't want, everything should be through the spoken word, and they don't want that to be documented. And this dialectic between practice and performance, whether it's in the ritual sphere or in the political sphere when they're making their claim with the state, especially in the case of India, because in Nepal, unfortunately, I think towards the end, I was looking for something like, okay, in the current political context, how have Thangnis asserted themselves? You know, what is their role in the Janjati movement? But I also noticed that this is probably like most of the data from 2008. And so my question to Sarah, when I asked him, email, how would you want me to talk about the book? And she said, just say what is important. And my question, I think, was that was unanswered in the book, is, and probably will never be answered. You know, what is their role right now in the movement? How powerfully have they been able to assert themselves positively? That also Janakji has raised, because right now, you know, this whole assertion of identity, and we see this in the book very beautifully, that they are really trying to make this positive assertion, but not just in the political sphere, you know, it's not just about politics of recognition, which we see a lot in sociological, anthropological literature. Sarah does talk about, you know, this recognition, politics of recognition, is not just in the political stage, but it's also at the, you know, the ritual level, the cultural level. What she also does is she takes these theoretical concepts of, let's say, doxa, habitus, practice, body, and some of the concepts, practice, performances, and she uses these concepts in a more dialectical, more active manner. And the other concept I also liked about what she used in the book is this whole concept of identity as doing. You know, we have a, so in my own work, the other thing Sarah told me is when you talk, see how you could relate it to your own work. And when I studied the Dalit movement and Dalit identity for my PhD thesis, that is one commonality I found. This sense of identity is not fixed. It's complex, it's more contextual, it's more fluid, it's negotiated, it's contested. And the same thing is shown in this book in ethnicity, you know, how in both Darjeeling and in Nepal, as time changes, as context changes, both politically, socially, and economically, that how the Thangnis are, in a sense, negotiating, they're adapting. And so you don't have this sixth sense of, you know, ethnicity. And towards the end of the book, it's very interesting. She actually says how, you know, they just stopped one of the rituals which used to be done in a public forum of drinking blood, and she actually is disappointed because she used that ritual, she wrote about it, and suddenly why it had stopped, but apparently that hadn't stopped like that, but they had brought it more into their own households because they didn't feel the need to do it publicly, you know. But so she's very in touch with these changes, and in my own work with Dalits, that's what I also found, you know, this identity, you know, it's not fixed. And this the claim for positive assertion to be recognized, you know, by the state in the case of Dalits. And there it goes beyond the politics of recognition, beyond the state. You know, here you see a lot of Thangnis from Darjeeling coming to Nepal actually to learn so much about the culture. Their sense of politics of recognition with the Indian state is different, but they want to come to Nepal to learn more about their original culture, you know. So all these very complex dimensions is also really unpacked in the book, and clearly you see, you know, the heterogeneity, in a sense, of the Thangnis, the differences between Thangnis of Darjeeling and Thangnis of Nepal, but at the same time also the commonality. And I think that has done very beautifully. And of course I had some questions. What I felt was missing in the book, although it was done beautifully, was the whole aspect of gender. Okay, so in the whole time reading the book, I almost had the image of the men mostly come, and of course there I had touched upon you know, the women when it comes to the chapter on the clans, the way the lineages are done, the myths, the stories of how the clans came about, and she also talks about very egalitarian relationships. But by and large, my question was, you know, okay, so what roles did women have in some of these rituals? Like, are they absent? I just felt maybe like that absence of the gender perspective, and maybe, I mean, it's not the objective of most authors also, you know, because your book has an objective, but I felt if there was a more gendered angle to the book, that probably would have enriched the book even more, because then I'm left with so many questions. You know, it's very clear in the book that men, by and large, are, you know, the gurus, they're mostly involved in the rituals, and men mostly are the main actors, you know, in most of the rituals, and even in terms of the circular migration. So it seems like the Thangni women do not migrate to Darjeeling. I was not sure. You know, so from that angle, maybe that's one area where in the future you could have a more gendered perspective to the book. I just, some of these questions kept coming up. But I think I would really recommend everybody to read the book. It's for everybody. You know, you don't have to be limited by disciplinary boundaries, because it's very accessible in terms of the way she's written, also for everybody. And for me also, as a Nepali, you know, I don't know anything about the Thangni culture. So like any other outsider, you know, it was very eye-opening, informative, and I learned so much. I mean, without the book I wouldn't have learned, you know, so it really increased my knowledge. So the ethnography is done by anybody, it's not just for the anthropologist. I think it's there for everybody. In the beginning, you know, Sarah does start by saying that you know, that she was worried when she began the project, that when she's looking at the ritualized nature of ethnicity, you know, she wanted to add value to the ethnographies already done there. I think she does add value, and she was worried that this field is already saturated, so what value would it add? And I think it's far from saturation, because the book actually leaves you with, you know, so many future research projects that could be conducted, you know, so many questions that still need to be answered about the Thangni community overall, and about, I think, also locating that within the larger Janjati movement. Thank you.
Thank you, Sabiti. Next we have Surin Thani. Surin is also a very good friend of mine. In fact, if Surin had not been a Thani, I might not have known Sarah and Mark back then. But of course, Surin is not here because he's a friend of mine. He's here mainly because, you know, for those of you who've been through the book, the profuse thanks that he receives for having been part of the entire process. I'll let him speak.
Well, good afternoon. I think the reason I'm here, the most important reason, is because I'm a Thami, right? And let me also make it clear, I'm not an academic or an anthropologist or a sociologist. So I'm not here to critique the book. And I need to be honest, I have skimmed through some of the chapters. I haven't completely read the book, Sarah. Sorry, Sarah. So what I'll do is actually I'll share a story with you people, the story of my family. So that might help, I don't know, add a whole new thing to this afternoon, a little bit of, you know, just away from what is being discussed very academically and stuff like that, okay? So it was way back in 1830s, I guess, you know, a Thami man falls in love with a supposedly high-class woman, and to avoid persecution, they elope and run away, you know. And the story goes that it took them several months to reach Darjeeling. And that was the time when Darjeeling was just being opened up and the East India Company was starting plantations and stuff like that. So there was no way this man could come back. So he settled there with this woman, you know, and he begets another child, and fast forward to 5 generations later, fast forward to 1924, my father was born, who is actually right here with us. We have a piece of history right here. My dad right here, who is 92 years old. You, Ella. So, then he gets his, I mean, he is sent to some basic education and all that. So, after his intermediate in arts, they used to call it IE in those days, he was conscripted by the British government and sent to Gorakhpur to as a recruitment officer, and that is where the story starts. Like, he meets my mother there, who is from West Nepal, from Sakola, who was visiting her relatives in Gorakhpur, you know. So they fall in love, they get married, and my father comes to Nepal. So it's a big circle kind of completed in 1950, and works as a teacher in Kokla, Then later on he had to go back to Darjeeling for a brief moment, and that's where I was born. So what I'm going to tell you about is basically what it has meant for me to be a Thami in those given circumstances, right? So in Darjeeling, our basic ethnic identity was, we spoke the Nepali language, we were Nepali. We were in a part of, we were part of this bigger state, and we were like minorities out there. So whoever spoke Nepali was a Nepali, and we had this sense of bonding. The language kind of did all the bonding, and that's what we were. And I still remember as a student going, you know, out in the street in protest, demanding the recognition of the Nepali language in the Indian constitution and all that. So it was very much a part of our identity, the Nepali language. Bhanu Bhakta was a big figure, you know, he's a very iconic figure, and he's almost a rebel, like it's almost worshipped. So every year during Bhanu Jayanti, many of you would know, like, it's celebrated with such fanfare, and you know, there's so much going on there. Then I completed my graduation, I come back to Nepal, then I suddenly realized, you know, like, it is that language that makes me different, okay, because the language that I thought gave me the identity was actually not me. So, that's our group. And even in Darjeeling, although at a different level, at a social level, there were times when you get Thami, you know, people would always question, like, tell us, Thami, when you go Kevo? That was a big question, like, that was a cardinal question to answer. So whenever we asked our parents, and all of you given the story about, you know, oh, we are like Tamans, oh, we are like Rais, or we are like Rimbus, and all that. So that has been one thing that I grew up with as a Thami, a big kind of an identity crisis, you know. So, and when I come to Nepal, it was further, like, it became even deeper, like I started questioning and all that. So people had their own languages, and I didn't speak my language. And that is when these two great minds met in Kalikandiki Valley, Mark and Sarah. I was in Kathmandu. And I called them my missing link, because Mark and Sarah were the people who took me first to a Thami village. I hadn't met many Thamis besides my own family, and we have just one or two Buharis, and we're also in-laws who are Thamis in my sixth son. Like, my dad is the eldest of 11 sons, and all of them are married, like in Gurung or Magar or Rai or something like that. So I've never actually met Thamis. So thanks to Mark and Sarah who took me to Chokiti. And that's when I met Manla Desai there, right there, who's sitting next to my dad. And they, I was reading a program for American students, and one of the core values for this group is like global citizenship, you know, and everything. And there I was suddenly realizing, like, oh God, I actually belong to the small group, you know, from deep inside. So, and the people at Chokiti wouldn't believe that I was a Thami. They just wouldn't. I had to actually take out my driver's license to show them I am actually a Thami. This wouldn't be a Thami would be leading a group of American students, you know, coming here as one of the instructors and all that. So that was very humbling, but also it also kind of empowered. It gave me a new sense of identity, which I think was has always been lacking there, you know. So that gave me a whole different perspective to what it means to belong, you know. Then I really want to thank Sarah and Mark for doing all this wonderful work. I'm sure Sarah's work will help us understand also better. And also it has also, I think, archival value, because Thamis like that, they suffer from huge self-esteem, so they wouldn't even speak their language in front of other community, other people and all that. So this has restored, I hope this helps them restore faith in their own community and you get provide a deeper level of understanding, which would be objective and factual as well, because there are a lot of emotional issues that go with identity, like, I mean, identity these days. So thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lastly, we have we've heard the gurus. Now we'll hear the activists. Sikwil Thani, Secretary of Nepal Thani Samaj.
Thank you very much, Deepak sir. First of all, Sakhalikai, Gaiko Long Sikiling Seva, Gaiko Bajibulu, Apama, Uchapa Uchama, Tethu Humi, Sakhalikai, Gaiko Seva, Gaiko Guru Padikai, Vaish Seva. I want to say many more thanks for the writer of this book, and especially for the organizer too, because they provide me a chance to speak here, and I can't talk about this book, but because of the movements in Nepal, as a social activist, I am also busy for this movement, and for this program I directly came from the movement in the state, as you know, all of you, and I had some problem in my voice too because of talking. We are searching for our identity. We are fighting for this state to our identity in the constitution, which is said that it will be written in the near future, and we want in that constitution our identity, our rights should not be missed or should not be destroyed us, because we are one of the highly marginalized community in the Nepal. The state of Nepal in BS 2058, all indigenous nationalities of Nepal are categorized in five categorization. Among them, Thami people are highly marginalized. So we are now the movements for the identity and our rights in the constitution. I have nothing more to say about this book because I cannot detailly study this book because of the same thing, motivation. We are very busy in these days on the street. You know that well. But I hope that this book will be a strong motivation for our community to develop our economical situation, political situation, social situation, and historical situation also. And the more sensitive aspect is that the cultural situation also. And I hope Sarah will be with us in the future too, because I think this book is very much for us, but this is not sufficient for our community, because many more hidden issues are in our community till now. And as a research expert, you and your colleagues too, we hope that you all will come in our society in future and also research for that hidden issues, which issues can be can be the identity for our society also. One thing in the book, the culture, drinking of the blood in Dolha district is not the identity of whole Thangmi in the Nepal and as well in India too, because this is the culture of a specific community of the Dolha. So it, I don't know what is in the book, but it will be, or it should be, indicate that the culture of drinking blood is not the identity of whole Thangmi people in Nepal and India too. That is I have to say for the writer, because some issues are maybe in future it will be create a violence in our community also, because as you said, the guru which has the only not a written text or written form which we finish all our cultural programs from birth to death, that aspect is also not clearly managed or not in Nepali. त्यो कुराहरू पनि विवाद रहित छैन, जुन कुराहरू चाहिँ यहाँहरूले अलिकति स्पष्ट रूपमा भनिदिनु भयो भने, अर्थात् रिसर्च गरिदिनु भयो भने हाम्रो लागि एकदमै त्यसलाई हामीले चाहिँ एउटा महत्त्वपूर्ण उसको रूपमा चाहिँ हामीले लिएका छौँ होइन. अर्को कुरा, हाम्रो समुदायमा एउटा इन्ट्रेस्टिङ फ्याक्ट भनेको के हो भन्दाखेरि, महिला र पुरुषको छुट्टा छुट्टै थर हुनु पनि हो, सायद त्यो कुरा पनि यहाँले लेखिदिनु भएको छ होला, जसले चाहिँ हाम्रो एउटा पहिचानलाई अर्थात् भनौँ आइडेन्टिटीलाई अगाडि ल्याउनको लागि चाहिँ एउटा स्ट्रङ आस्पेक्ट रूपमा त्यो अगाडि आउँछ भन्ने हो. त्यसको मतलब हाम्रो कम्युनिटीमा चाहिँ जेन्डर बायस छैन भन्ने नै हो. हामीले महिला पुरुषलाई समान रूपमा हेर्ने प्रचलन पहिलादेखि थिएछ भन्ने हो, र अहिले आएर चाहिँ अब हाम्रोमा त्यस्तो नहुन पनि सक्छ, किनभने त्यो पछाडि आएर राज्यमा चाहिँ जुन परिवर्तन आयो त्यसले गर्दा हाम्रो समुदायलाई पनि त्यो राज्यको परिवर्तन र राज्यको संस्कारले चाहिँ हाम्रो समुदायलाई गाँजेको हुनाले त्यही कल्चर चाहिँ हामीले अप्नाइरहनु परेको त्यो एउटा बाध्यता पनि हो. यहाँलाई म सरी भन्न चाहन्छु, मैले इङ्ग्लिसमा राम्रोसँग यहाँहरू मार्क बोल्न पाइनँ, किनभने म अहिले सिकाइकै क्रममा छु, अनि स्टुडेन्ट पनि हो है. अर्को कुरा, राम्रोसँग पढ्न पाइँदैन, अब सानैदेखि हामीले चाहिँ यो जिम्मेवारी बहन गरिरहनु परेको छ होइन, एउटा हाम्रो आइडेन्टिटी को लागि हाम्रो अधिकारको लागि हामी यो देशमा भएर पनि यो देशको एउटा नागरिक भएर पनि नागरिकको रूपमा हामी चाहिँ बसिरहेका छौँ भनेर भनिरहेका छौँ र हाम्रो माग भन्ने चाहिँ त्यही नै हो। हुन त अब जातीय कुरा गर्दा जातीय राज्यहरू माग्ने यताउता भन्ने आक्षेप पनि लाइन्छ हामीमा, त्यो स्वाभाविक पनि हो। तर हामीले भनेको चाहिँ के हो भन्दाखेरि इक्वल राइट्सहरू चाहिँ सबै जात जातिमा भयो भने यदि कुनै एउटा जातिले अर्को जातिले कुनै एउटा कम्युनिटीले अर्को कम्युनिटीलाई बायस गरेन भने त्यो समुदायमा चाहिँ शान्ति दिगो शान्ति भइरहन सक्छ र दिगो शान्ति भनेको चाहिँ यो देश विकासको एउटा मूल खम्बा हो भन्ने हामीले त्यसलाई लिएको छौँ होइन। त्यसले गर्दाखेरि जबसम्म देशमा हाम्रो समुदायमा चाहिँ एउटा बायसनेस भन्ने कुरा रहिरहन्छ तबसम्म देशले चाहिँ शान्ति पाउँदैन, किनभने बायसनेस जहाँ हुन्छ त्यहाँ एउटा विद्रोहको आवाज आउँछ नि, विद्रोह आउनु भनेको अशान्ति हुनु हो। त्यसले गर्दाखेरि यदि समान अधिकार सबैलाई प्रदान गरियो भने स्टेटले पनि त्यो चाहिँ अब हामीलाई चाहिँ अहिले हामीले मागिरहेको छ, यदि त्यो समान रूपमा अधिकारहरूको वितरण गर्ने हो भने सबैलाई आफ्नो जातीय भाषिक सांस्कृतिक पहिचानहरू दिने हो भनेदेखि त्यहाँ कसैले कसैमाथि झगडा गर्ने अर्थात् हामी समुदायले राज्यमाथि हाम्रो चाहिँ यो यस्तो माग हो, हाम्रो यो सांस्कृतिक पहिचान चाहियो, हाम्रो पनि भाषा छ, हामी आफ्नै भाषामा पढ्न चाहन्छौँ, तर हामीलाई चाहिँ हामी पढ्न चाहँदा चाहँदै पनि हाम्रो आर्थिक अवस्था कमजोर भएको कारणले गर्दाखेरि हामी आफै स्कुलहरू स्थापना गरेर पढाउन सक्दैनौँ हाम्रो बालबच्चालाई, त्यसैले त्यसको व्यवस्था गराइदिनु भन्ने खालको कुराहरू हामीले भन्नै पर्थेन। यस्तो एउटा उदाहरणको लागि मात्रै भनेको, त्यसरी भन्नु नपर्दाखेरि देशमा अशान्ति पनि हुँदैन थियो, अर्थात् यस्तो खालको मुभमेन्टमा हामी लागिरहनु पनि पर्ने थिएन, किनभने अब पुलिसको डन्डा खाँदै घाम तातो रातमा रापिँदै हामीलाई पनि रहर छैन। तर हामी एउटा मार्जिनलाइज ग्रुप भएको हिसाबमा संख्यामा थोरै छौँ, अब त्यही आधारमा यहाँहरूले बुझिहाल्नुहुन्छ, त्यसैले गर्दाखेरि पनि हामी थोरै संख्यामा भए पनि हाम्रो हक अधिकार स्थापित गर्नको लागि चाहिँ नेपाल आदिवासी जनजाति महासङ्घ भनेको हाम्रो एउटा छाता सङ्गठन हो, सम्पूर्ण आदिवासी जनजातिहरूको सूचीकृत 59 आदिवासी जनजाति मध्ये एउटा जाति त आदिवासी जनजाति त पाइएको पनि छैन, फ्री भन्ने जाति 58 भयो, तर दुईटा आदिवासी जनजातिहरूले अहिलेसम्म त्यो आफ्नो मातृसत्ता खोल्न नसकेको ले गर्दाखेरि 56 आदिवासी जनजातिहरू चाहिँ त्यो जनजाति महासङ्घमा आबद्ध भएर अहिले मुभमेन्टमा लागिरहेको छौँ। यो एउटा तपाईँहरूलाई जानकारी भयो, अनि उहाँहरूले पनि भन्नुभएको छ, सरहरूले पनि भनिसक्नु भएको छ, हाम्रो नेपाल खानी समाज भनेको 2056 सालमा चाहिँ विधिवत रूपमा स्थापना भएको हो र त्यसको चाहिँ हाल म महासचिव भएर काम गरिरहेको छु। यो हाम्रो एउटा प्रतिनिधिमूलक संस्था हो, सम्पूर्ण देशभरिको प्रतिनिधिमूलक संस्था भएको हुनाले मलाई चाहिँ के लाग्छ भन्दाखेरि स्टडीको क्रममा मेरो चाहिँ घर पूर्व सुदूरपूर्व इलाम हो, इलामको पनि अझै सुदूरपूर्व दार्जिलिङसँग बोर्डर मेरो एकदम छुन्छ र हाम्रो बजार भनेको पनि दार्जिलिङ नै हो, हामी त्यहाँ एक दिन नै गएर फर्किन सक्छौँ। तर अब उहाँहरू झापासम्म जानुभएछ, तर इलाम चाहिँ पूर्वाञ्चलको फेरि सबैभन्दा बढी खामीहरू भएको जिल्ला हो इलाम चाहिँ, त्यसैले गर्दा पनि उहाँहरू त्यहाँसम्म पनि आइदिनु भएको भए हामी आभारी हुने थियौँ। तर यसको मतलब मैले उहाँलाई किन आउनु भएन भन्ने पनि होइन, किनभने उहाँको यो रिसर्च अन्तिम होइन जस्तो लाग्छ मलाई, किन अझै हाम्रो समुदायमा उहाँहरू आउनुहुनेछ, उहाँ लगायत उहाँको कलिग्सहरू उहाँले लिएरै आउनुहुनेछ। त्यसको लागि पूर्वाञ्चलको चाहिँ इलाम झापा मोरङ सुनसरी उदयपुर भोजपुर खोटाङसम्म छानेहरूको बसोबास रहेको छ र मलाई लाग्छ इलाम र भोजपुरमा पनि कम्पेरिजन गर्यो भने फरक पाउन सक्छौँ। त्यो कुराहरू पनि त्यहाँ सबैतिर यदि गइरहेको भए अझै यो बुक राम्रो हुने थियो जस्तो लाग्छ मलाई। तर मैले अघि पनि भनिसकेँ रिसर्च भन्ने बित्तिकै एउटा रिसर्चले फेरि अर्को रिसर्च गर्दाखेरि त्यो अघिल्लो रिसर्चमा भएको कुराहरूलाई त्यसले फेल पनि गराउन सक्छ, त्यसैले गर्दाखेरि त्यो अब उहाँहरूलाई थाहै छ। यति भन्दै मेरो नेपाली र अङ्ग्रेजी मिक्स भएको बनाइदिँदाखेरि यही राख्दै बिदा हुन चाहन्छु सबैलाई, सेवा फेरि धन्यवाद, नमस्कार।
धेरै धन्यवाद छ सुखबीरजीलाई र सबैजना साथीहरूलाई, मलाई चाहिँ तपाईँहरूको कुरो सुनेर एकदम खुसी लाग्यो। Thank you very much, everybody. I'll just speak very briefly because I want to have some time for questions, but just to respond to a few of the things directly. These are very wonderful comments and thoughts and questions, and I'm really so very lucky to have your all these contributions. Sukhbirji, pahile te kuraga ho, haina, kina alam gaina hami haru pahile ni. Ilam pani jane kura thyo, tara chai अब यति धेरै ठाउँ अब एकैजना चाहिँ पुग्न सकिँदैन अनि साँच्चै नै त्यो ढोला र सिन्धु फालचोक मात्रै राम्रोसित बुझ्नुलाई अनि ठाउँ ठाउँ घुम्नुलाई पनि धेरै समय पनि लाग्यो अनि झापा चाहिँ किन अनुसन्धान गरेको छ नि तपाईँको चाहिँ पूर्वतिर भनेर हामी विदेशीहरूलाई इलामको फासुफाटी नगरबाट चाहिँ दार्जिलिङ जान दिँदैन अनि हामीले चाहिँ फेरि यता उता बाटोमा चाहिँ जाँदाखेरि नै अला यो झापामा पनि खस्नु पर्यो अनि त्यसले गर्दा चाहिँ अब के कन्भिनियन्सले गर्दा होला होइन तर त्यहाँ पनि एउटा के उदाहरण भनेको थियो इस्टर्न छानी कम्युनिटीको उदाहरण पनि लिएको थियो अनि मेरो आशा पनि छ अब आगामीमा पनि अर्को रिसर्चरहरू अनुसन्धान गर्नेहरूले चाहिँ अब इलामतिर पनि जानुपर्छ जस्तो लाग्छ अनि तपाईँले भन्नुभएको कुरोको ठाङ र बोल्सपुरको सुनमा ग्रुपमा रिसर्च गर्न पनि एकदम राम्रो हुन्थ्यो अनि मेरो आशा छ नि यो कोठामा पनि यङ रिसर्चर्सहरू छ भने उतैतिर पनि एकदम राम्रो हुन्थ्यो सर आई थिङ्क विल बी सम भेरी इन्ट्रेस्टिङ फर्दर रिसर्च टु बी डन इन मेनी अफ दिज एरियाज बट सुपर स्पोक अप सो थ्याङ्क यू फर द्याट एन्ड you know, I think Sukhbir answered some of somebody's question about what is the Thangni movement like right now. I won't say more about it, just in the interest of time. But also because, as I said, I finished with my own active research around 2008, and I've done my best to keep in touch and stay up to date and continue to collect information and documentation. But I have not been able to sort of analyze that in detail in the way that I did the earlier material for the book. So that's also work to be done. I can just say anecdotally that there's been a huge sea change in the way that the Thangni ethnic associations are able to engage at the national level, and that's a credit to many of the people in this room, in addition to Sukhbir, who have written a great deal, who have put the time in to be out there on the street and to be active also in the Janajati organizations, because I should say that the challenge was not simply recognition from the state, but also recognition from within the existing political structures, say of the Janajati Mahasangh, for instance, early on. And I think what I see now is a very, very different set of relationships that I've been really pleased to see develop, and I think it's a kind of remarkable accomplishment in terms of how young Thangni community members are engaged and the kind of range of ways that they have to participate in politics at both the district and regional and national level. And then just briefly on the issue of gender, it's funny, some people know that this is something I kind of constantly struggle with. My own earliest research was actually about gender. It wasn't with the Thangni, it was in Mustan on female religious practitioners. And so this is something that has been an issue for me throughout Thangni research. In a sense, I didn't want to prioritize it as my key sort of way into the set of questions, because I really wanted to do something more like a kind of holistic, classical ethnography for all of the reasons that I described here. But I realized after the fact that in a sense I had kind of, you know, let the pendulum swing too far back in the other direction. I did toy with including a whole chapter on gender at some point, and unfortunately that had to go just due to the word limits. And I do have an article that I would like to write which would complement the book specifically on gender dynamics, which has to do particularly with how the clan relationships and the practice of parallel descent that you mentioned, and that Sukhbir also mentioned, structures gender relations and how people basically imagine identity in relation to that. And then, let's see, finally, Janak asked this question of, is it really the same in Nepal as in India? Are people having to perform in the same way? And I think, you know, no, the answer is no, because the contexts are so very different. And yet I think that we really do need to look, take a close look at how those structures of recognition do exist here in Nepal and the many ways that people who want to be recognized, whether it's via ethnicity or caste or gender or region, the many ways that people do need to explicitly demonstrate those identities in order to have them be recognizable. And I think that was the issue that many Tangmi faced at the time I started my work, that the kind of categories through which they defined themselves to themselves were not the ones that external audiences could grasp. And so yes, I do think there is a necessity in Nepal to basically align oneself with a certain set of kind of representational tropes, a certain kind of way of representing oneself that people can understand and therefore you know, sort of engage with. So I'll leave it at that for now. Thank you all very much. And I realize it's quite late, but I hope people will stay on for a bit more question, answer, and discussion, and I'm happy to talk further. Thank you.
Yes, we're open now for questions and comments. Directed to anyone, okay.